Okay, I don't know if you know this, but the first draft of the movie Star Wars was actually not written by Lucas and company. The first draft of the movie Star Wars was written by environmentalists, and it was quite a bit different. Actually, is there anybody in here who does not know the plot of the movie Star Wars? Two courageous, three courage, four. Is this what happens every time? It's like one person raises their hand, like everybody else is like. So like five or six people don't know the plot. That's great that you don't know. I mean, it was wonderful, actually. So for those of you who don't know the plot of the movie Star Wars came out in what, 19... ...1977, which was the perfect time for it to come out, so far as I was concerned, because I was in high school, and I went to see it and just thought it was fabulous. And then I went back and told all my friends, you've got to see this movie. The acting is so good. And then... my friends went to see the movie. We all went to see the movie. We're not those, you know, nerds who saw it like 1,000 times or anything. I mean, for one thing, we weren't nerds. And for another thing, we were way too busy playing Dungeons and Dragons. And, so anyway, the plot of the movie Star Wars is that the rebels, or the Empire has built this big machine that is capable of destroying entire planets. And of course, it's a wonderful metaphor for the dominant culture, which is a giant machine that's destroying a planet. Anyway, so the Empire has built this machine called the Death Star that's capable of destroying entire planets, and then the rebels figure out a way to blow up the Death Star, and then in the exciting final scene, Luke Skywalker uses the Force to get past all the TIE fighters and then drop a torpedo down a thermal exhaust. Okay, so we're kind of nerds. Oh, wait. Okay, so anyway, Luke Skywalker uses a Force to get past all TIE fighters, drop a torpedo down a thermal exhaust port, and blow up the whole Death Star. And I've really just ruined the movie for you. But it's still worth seeing just for the acting. So that's how the real movie Star Wars went. And the environmentalist version was a little bit different. For one thing, it wasn't called Star Wars. Instead, it was called Star Nonviolent Civil Disobedience. And in this version, the rebels don't actually blow up the Death Star. Instead, they use other tactics to slow the intergalactic march of Empire. For example, they set up programs for people on planets about to be destroyed to produce luxury items like hemp hacky sacks and gourmet coffee for sale to inhabitants of the Death Star. Audience members will also discover there are plans afoot to encourage loads of troopers and other citizens of the Empire to take eco-tours of doomed planets. The purpose will be to show to one and all that these planets are economically important to the Empire and so should not be destroyed. In a surprise move that will get viewers to the edges of their seats, other groups of rebels file lawsuits against the Empire, attempting to show that the environmental impact statement that Darth Vader was required to file failed to adequately support his decision that blowing up the planet would cause no significant impact. Viewers will thrill to learn of plans to boycott items produced by corporations that have Darth Vader on the board of directors. And they'll leap to their feet in theaters worldwide when they see bags full of letters written directly to Mr. Vader himself, asking that he please not blow up any more planets. And scribbled in the margin is a note from one of the screenwriters. For accuracy's sake, when we show examples of these letters, it is imperative that all letters to Mr. Vader be respectful and courteous, that they stress the need to find cooperative solutions to the differences between the rebels and the Empire. Under no circumstances should the letters be such that they would alienate or anger Mr. Vader. If the letters upset Mr. Vader, the rebels' letter campaign to the Grand Moff Tarkin will certainly fail as well. Now, we all know that that would be sufficient not only to bring the Empire to its knees, but to make a damn fine and exciting movie. The thing is, there's more. Thousands of renegade rebels, unhappy with what they perceive as toadying on the part of the mainstream rebels, decide, in a scene guaranteed to bring tears to the eyes of even the most cold-hearted theatergoers, to stand on the planets about to be destroyed, link arms, and sing Give Peace a Chance. They send DVDs of that to Darth Vader and his boss, the Grand Moff Tarkin, to whom they also send wave after wave of loving kindness. A few of the rebels sneak aboard the Death Star, and they lock themselves down to various pieces of equipment. And stirring debates are held on screen among those rebels as to whether they should voluntarily surrender on approach of the troopers or whether they should remain locked down to the end. And in a brilliant and brave touch of authenticity, the rebels are never able to come to consensus. So once inside the Death Star, there's a splinter group of these rebels breaks off from those about to lock themselves down. And they rush down all these hallways, and they avoid all the troopers, and they burn a couple of transporters, and they use chemicals to etch Galaxy Liberation Front on the walls of the Death Star. And there's another group that breaks off from them, and they sneak past more troopers, and they make it all the way to Darth Vader's secret headquarters. He's there all by himself, and they sneak up behind him, and they hit him with a vegan cream pie. And near the end of the movie, there's another debate held among the rebels. And that was actually a problem that I had with the environmental screenplay, is that there was a bit too much debate and not quite enough action. So as the Death Star looms directly overhead, a few of the rebels actually advocate picking up weapons to fight back. And those rebels are generally shouted down by the pacifist rebels, who argue that attacking those who run the Death Star is just another example of the Empire's harmful philosophy coming in by the back door. They state that the rebels who want to fight back are simply being co-opted by the need to control things. They say that you can't use the Master's tools to dismantle the Master's Death Star. If we want to change Darth Vader, they say, we must first become that change ourselves. To change Darth Vader's heart, we must first change our own. We must above all else have compassion for Darth Vader and remember that he, too, was once a child. One writer put in the margins, excellent, that will be sure to moisten the cheeks of sensitive people everywhere. He didn't say whether those tears would be of frustration. Anyway, finally, Leia, Luke, Han, Chewbacca, and a couple of robots show up, and they tell the others that they found a way to blow up the whole Death Star. And all the other rebels, of course, are just horrified. They say that you, Leia, Luke, Han, and Chewbacca are heartless and cruel. So in the exciting final scene of the environmentalist version, there's a scuffle breaks out between Leia, Luke, Han, and Chewbacca on one side and the pacifists on the other. And the pacifists chase those four from the room and from the film, which isn't a big deal because they're minor characters anyway. Anyway, so what happens at the end of the movie is that the Death Star looms closer and closer. And you see the planet, and you see the Death Star, you see the planet, you see the Death Star, and you see the lasers start to glow this hellish red. And you see the planet, and then there's a little spark. That's the environmentalist getting away before the planet gets blown up. And then you see the lasers once again, and then it blows up the planet. And then the final shot of the movie, which reveals what a complete triumph this was for the rebels, is a still showing an article on the lower left of page 43 of the New Empire Times, which devotes a full 3 sentences to the destruction of the planet. So it's like, yeah, we got some press. That's the end of the story. So I was doing a talk in Asheville, North Carolina a few years ago, and after the talk during Q&A, this one guy said, so how many environmentalists does it take to change a light bulb? I said, I don't know. I'll bite. How many? And he said, it wasn't a riddle. I was actually asking the question. That's not how it's supposed to work. And so I went back to my hotel room, and I really fixated, obsessed was probably the word, on that question of how many environmentalists does it take to change a light bulb, which frankly says a lot more about my social life than I want it to. And I finally came up with an answer. And how many environmentalists does it take to change a light bulb? And the answer is 10. 1 to write the light bulb letter requesting that it change. 4 to circulate online petitions. 1 to file a lawsuit demanding that it change. 1 to send the light bulb loving kindness, knowing that's the only way real change occurs. 1 to accept the light bulb precisely the way it is, clear in the knowledge that to not accept another is to do great harm to oneself. 1 to write a book about how and why the light bulb needs to change. And finally, 1 to smash the fucking light bulb because we all know it's never going to change. I have to tell you, it is so great to be in front of an audience where I don't have to explain that joke. It's like, light bulb, culture, get it? So as a long-time grassroots environmental activist, and as a creature living in the thrashing endgame of civilization, I am intimately acquainted with the landscape of loss and have grown accustomed to carrying the daily weight of despair. I've walked clear cuts that wrap around mountains, drop into valleys, and climb ridges to fragment watershed after watershed. that I've sat silent near empty streams that two generations ago were lashed into whiteness by uncountable salmon coming home to spawn and die. A few years ago, I began to feel pretty apocalyptic, but I hesitated to use that word, in part because of those cartoons I've seen of crazy penitents carrying the end is near signs, and in part because of the power of the word itself, apocalypse. I didn't want to use it lightly. And then a friend and fellow activist said to me, "So Derek, what's it going to take for you to finally use that word? Will it take the death of flocks of passenger pigeons so large that they darken the sky for days at a time, flying 60 miles an hour and sounding like rolling thunder?" That was here. Or maybe it'll take the death of runs of salmon so large that people were afraid to put their boats in the water for fear they'd capsize. So large you couldn't see the bottom of the river. So large that you'd hear them from miles before you'd see them. So large that horses are afraid to get in the water. So large that they would keep you awake at night with the sound of their slapping of their tails against the water. Maybe it'll take the collapse of migratory songbird populations. Maybe it'll take turning the sea off San Diego into a dead zone. Maybe it'll take, there is 6 to 10 times as much plastic as there is phytoplankton in the oceans. 6 to 10 times as much. That's the equivalent of every time you take a bite, there's a 90% chance that it's going to be styrofoam. If forests were covered to the similar amount, that would mean that all the temperate forests were covered to 90 feet thick in styrofoam. Maybe it'll take dioxin, every mother's breast milk on the planet. Maybe it'll take, the last of the great apes. You know, give me a specific threshold, Derek, a specific point at which you finally use that word. The book Endgame, and then also this talk, are really based around the question, do you believe that this culture will undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? I ask that question all over, and nobody ever says yes. A lot of people laugh. It's a stupid question. Of course it won't. And the next question is, if you don't believe that the culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living, what does that mean for your strategy and your tactics if you care about life on this planet? And the answer is we don't know. And one of the reasons we don't know is because we don't talk about it. And one of the reasons we don't talk about it is because we're all so busy pretending that we have hope. And I'm going to do some serious hope bashing later. It's one of my favorite things to do. We're losing badly on all fronts. And there are a lot of reasons for this. One of the reasons that environmentalists generally lose is because I don't think a lot of us want to win. And there's so many reasons that we lose so often. And one of them also is there's this great book by Robert J. Lifton called The Nazi Doctors. And in this book, he asks the question, how is it that people who had taken the Hippocratic Oath could go and work in Nazi death camps? How could doctors go and work in Nazi death camps? And what he found was that most of the doctors actually cared very deeply about the inmates, and they would do everything they could to help the inmates. Everything in their power, they would, if the inmate was in pain, they would give the inmate an aspirin to lick, or they would hide them from selection officers who were going to kill them, would put them to bed for a day or two. They would do everything they could except for the most important thing of all, which is to question the existence of the death camp itself. And they wouldn't step out of the death camp mentality. And we as environmentalists so often do the same thing. I know so many people who are working so hard. We are hanging on by our fucking fingernails, trying to protect this or that piece of ground or this or that creature whom we love. And we're doing everything we can except for questioning the existence of this entire culture that has turned the entire planet into first a work camp and then a death camp. And that's not good enough for me. It's not good enough for me to just make it so a couple more generations of salmon or steelhead or chickadees live out harried lives before they're ultimately exterminated. I want to win. And how I define winning is that I want to live in a world that has more wild salmon every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that has more boreal chickadees every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that has more whippoorwills every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that has less dioxin in every mother's breast milk every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world where the oceans aren't being murdered. 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. 90%. And I want to live in a world with more large fish in the oceans every year than the year before. And I'll do whatever it takes to get there. So the structure of the rest of the talk is that one of the things I do in Endgame is I lay out a number of premises, and then I go through the premises one by one, and that's what I want to do for this evening. And one of the reasons I lay out the premises explicitly is that one of the first rules of propaganda is if you can slide your premises by people, you've got them. So, for example, Adolf Hitler would say, "So, what are we going to do about the Jewish problem?" I was like, "God, Adolf, that's a good question. What are we going to do about it?" But what he did is he slid past you the idea that there's a Jewish problem you have to do something about in the first place. And, you know, of course, that was a long time ago, and we know that, you know, propaganda really doesn't exist today. And, but you can have, you know, what, you can hear some talking head on television say, "So, how can we make the U.S. economy grow?" Good question. How can we make the U.S. economy grow? Well, premise one, we want the U.S. economy to grow. Premise two, we want the U.S. economy to exist. Premise three, who the hell's we? And so I don't want to do that. I don't want to cheat and slide premises by you, so I'm gonna try to lay them out as clearly as I can. First premise, industrial civilization is not and can never be sustainable. Industrial civilization is not and can never be sustainable. Every civilization, in fact, is not sustainable. That's not every culture. That's every civilization. There's a difference. And so a few years ago, I was riding in a car with a friend of mine, and I said, "So, George, if you could live at any level of technology that you wanted, what would it be?" And George is a nice guy, but sometimes he's kind of a curmudgeon, and that day he was not in a very good mood. And he said, "Derek, that's a really stupid question. We can fantasize whatever we want, but the truth is there's only one level of technology that's sustainable, and that's the Stone Age. And we will be living at that level of technology again someday, and the only question really is what's left of the world when we get there." It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that any way of living that's based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last. In fact, I would say it takes anybody but a rocket scientist to figure that one out. So this is true no matter what resource you're talking about. If you're talking about, you know, that Mexican restaurant's actually just as good the second time around. It doesn't matter what the resource is. If every year there's less copper or zinc or whatever than there was the year before, eventually you're going to run out. You know, if you have 100 units of something, and the next year 99, 98, 97, eventually you get to zero. And so, I don't know, you'd think that if you had an entire economy based on the use of, I don't know, let's take a random example, oil, that you would ask yourself what you're going to do when the oil runs out. I'm just saying. So once again, any way of life that's based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last. But I'm going to take it a step further. And I'm going to say that any way of life that's based on the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources won't last. So if every year there are fewer salmon return than there were the year before, eventually there won't be any. If every year there are fewer smelt return, what are those? If every year there are fewer passenger pigeons, if every year there are fewer Eskimo curlews? If every year there are fewer great auks, does anybody in here know why there are no penguins in the Northern Hemisphere? There were. They were called great auks, A-U-K-S. And there were so many in the North Atlantic that on just one island, one French explorer said that you could fill every ship in France and it wouldn't make a dent. Well, they did, and it did, and the last one was killed in the 19th century. So if every year there are fewer of whomever there, eventually going to get to zero. You know, if there are 100 units of it, and or if there are 100 beings, and then every year there are 10 more, but then you're killing off 20 a year, eventually there'll be zero. So I'm going to take it a step further. Oh, wait, before we go on about that, it's like, wait. This is just too much, Derek, because actually we all know, we've been taught again and again, that life is based on survival of the fittest, which really means survival of the meanest. You know, it's like big fish eat little fish, and then, you know, corporate fish eat all the fish. And so it's all, you know, that's what it is. It's really survival of the meanest. It's just that's how you survive, is by being the best at exploiting. We hear this all the time. Well, to show how stupid our discourse is, I can disprove that in one sentence if you give me a couple semicolons. And that is, those creatures who have survived in the long run have survived in the long run, semicolon. You don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings, semicolon. You survive in the long run by actually improving your habitat. I know that's weird for us to think about, but actually that's what salmon do, is they actually make the forest a healthier place. That's what other cultures have done, is actually improve their habitat. It's like Dolores LaChapelle, who died last year, taught me that it's not survival of the fittest, it's survival of the fit, which is how well you fit into your habitat, how well you fit into your surroundings. Wait a second. I'm going to take it a step further, and I'm going to say, I'm going to take a step further and say that any way of life that's based on the use of resources won't last. Because the truth is that resources don't exist. There is no such thing. Because trees don't consider themselves a timber resource, and salmon don't consider themselves a fisheries resource. They're just trees, and they're just fish. This is really important because if you perceive the world as made up of resources, resources are something for you to use. There's a great book by R.D. Lang called The Politics of Experience. And the fundamental point of that book, I'm going to ruin Star Wars and now Politics of Experience. The fundamental point of that book is that how you perceive the world affects how you behave in the world. And a really good example of this is that there's a great line by a Canadian lumberman. When I look at trees, I see dollar bills. If when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. If when you look at trees, you see trees, you'll treat them another way. If when you look at this particular tree, you see this particular tree, you'll treat it differently still. Same is true for salmon. If when I look at salmon, I see dollar bills, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at salmon, I see salmon, I'm going to treat them another way. If when I look at this particular salmon, I see this particular salmon, I'll treat her differently still. Same is true for women. If when I look at women, I see orifices, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at women, I see women, I'll treat them another way. If when I look at this particular woman, I see this particular woman, I'll treat her differently still. And just because when I look at this particular fish, I see this particular fish, by the way, doesn't mean that I can't eat it. Oh, I'm going to tell you, it takes me a couple years to develop a talk. And what I do is, you know, I try jokes, see if they work, see if they don't work, whatever. And then also I'll try transitions and see if they work. And I'll tell you a transition I tried one night, which was I don't really like it that I go trees, fish, women, and then back to fish. You know, when I look at a tree, I see dollar bills, whatever. So I go trees, fish, women, back to trees. Back to fish. That seemed like an uncomfortable one. So one night, I tried the transition instead of just because I look at this particular fish, I see this particular fish, doesn't mean I can't eat it. I tried the transition instead. Just because when I look at this particular woman, I see this particular woman, doesn't mean I can't eat her. So the person who brought me to do that talk was this woman in her 60s, and after the talk was done, she was standing in the back doing her best Queen Victoria impression. It's like, we are not amused. Anyway, so just because I see this particular fish doesn't mean that I can't eat this fish. I was doing a radio interview in Spokane, Washington a few years ago, and the interviewer at one point said, you know, Indians exploited salmon too. And I said, no, they didn't. They ate them. And so, well, what's the difference? I said, well, they gave him respect for the spirit in exchange for the flesh. I knew that answer was kind of bullshit, but I'm a male, and so I'm required by law to answer every question that's asked of me. And so later on, I went out and I sat next to this tree that I had a long relationship with, and I asked the tree, so what is the fundamental predator-prey relationship? And the tree gave me the answer right away, which is, if you consume the flesh of another, you now take responsibility for the continuation of the other community. So if I consume flesh of salmon from the Klamath River, I now take responsibility for the continuation of the Klamath River salmon community. And this is true on a cosmic woo-woo level, and it's true on a spiritual level. It's true on a straight carbon cycle level. It's true on every level. I mean, the mergansers know it. The bears know it. The mergansers know that if they eat every newt in a pond, there's not going to be any newts left next year, and the newts and the mergansers won't be able to live. They know this. Everybody knows this, except we forget. Okay, that's all fine, Derek, but, it's great that, we can't live with, we can't base a way of life on non-renewable resources, et cetera, but what does it have to do with civilization? Well, I've been bashing civilization for 15 years now, or 20 years or something, and I figured with this book I probably better finally define it. And civilization I've defined as a way of life characterized by the growth of cities. And that's defensible both historically and linguistically. Civilization is a way of life characterized by the growth of cities. That's nice, Derek, but what's a city? So a city, I've defined as people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. People living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. And what that means is that the Talawa Indians, on whose land I now live, were not civilized. They didn't live in cities. They lived in villages, camps, and they lived there for 12,500 years, if you believe the myths of science. That's 600 human generations. If you believe the myths of the Talawa, they lived there since the beginning of time. In any case, it's a long time. And, I gotta tell you this. I was doing a talk at Princeton University a couple years ago, and I said the thing about the Talawa lived there for 12,500 years, and this one guy in the audience said, well, that doesn't mean they were living there sustainably. We'll just leave that. Two things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources. One is that your way of living can never be sustainable. Because if you require the importation of resources, it means you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource. And as your city grows, you'll denude an ever larger area. And remember, the only way you can live sustainably is if you're actually improving your habitat. If you're harming your habitat, you're not going to live there sustainably. And they say that one sign of intelligence is the ability to recognize patterns. So I'm going to lay out a pattern here, and let's see if we can recognize it in less than 6,000 years. And that's when you think of Iraq, is the first thing you think of is cedar forest so thick that sunlight never touches the ground? That's what Iraq was prior to the beginnings of this culture. One of the first written myths of this culture is Gilgamesh deforesting the plains and hillsides of Iraq to make cities. And the Saudi Arabian Peninsula was oak savanna. Then moved to the Near East. We've all heard about the cedars of Lebanon. Yeah, they still have one on their flag. And Greece was heavily forested. There were lions in Greece. And Plato or Socrates or one of those dead guys said that he complained that deforestation was harming water quality. And I have absolutely no doubt that the Greek EPA said that they need to study it for a few years to make sure there's a correlation. North Africa was heavily forested. Those forests went down for the Phoenician and Egyptian navies. This culture has been eating land bases for a long time, and it's reached the end of the world. It's like there's a great line, you can't have, what is it? Only a madman or an economist would think you can have infinite growth on a finite planet. Eventually you run out of further places to exploit. So that's the first thing is it can't be sustainable. If your way of life requires the importation of resources, it can't be sustainable. Second thing it means is that your way of life must be based on violence. Because if you require the importation of resources, trade will never be sufficiently reliable. Because if you require the importation of resources and the people in the next watershed over have some resource that you need, you're going to take it if they won't trade you for it. Which all means we could become junior bodhisattvas, and the U.S. military would still have to be huge. Because how else is the U.S. going to get access to the oil that they need to run the economy? I mean, I'm really interested to see what happens over the next 5-10 years if the Canadians decide that they don't want to send water and they don't want to allow the United States to steal water and tar sands, to develop the resources. If the Canadians don't want to allow the United States to steal those resources, I'll be very interested to see what sort of good neighbor policy that the United States has. In fact, I'm going to start the process right now. The Canadians are known to harbor weapons of mass destruction and terrorists. Did you know, I'm sure you know, that William Shatner is a known Canadian. And William Shatner and Osama bin Laden have never been seen in the same room together. As an actor, he's very good at disguise. Think about it. Okay, so that's the first premise, is that industrial civilization is not and can never be sustainable. That's the first premise right here. So you all brought sleeping bags, right? Okay, premise two. Traditional communities do not often voluntarily give up or sell the resources on which their communities are based until their communities have been destroyed. They also do not willingly allow their land bases to be damaged so that other resources, gold, oil, and so on, can be extracted. It follows that those who want the resources will do what they can to destroy traditional communities. We've seen that once or twice on this continent. Third premise. Our way of living, industrial civilization, is based on, requires, and would collapse very quickly without persistent and widespread violence. Our way of living, industrial civilization, is based on, requires, and would collapse very quickly without persistent and widespread violence. Now, a few years ago, I was doing a talk in Eugene, Oregon, and afterwards, this one guy, it's very important he's a guy for reasons I'll tell you in a minute, this one guy said, you know, you talk about this culture being based on violence, but I just don't see it. I don't see violence anywhere. I don't allow violence in anywhere near me. I don't commit violence. And I don't allow anybody to use any words that start with V in my presence. So it doesn't happen. And A, it's very significant that it was a guy who said this, because the gold standard studies of the rate of sexual assault of women in this culture is about 25%. 25% of all women are raped in their lifetime. Another 19% fend off rape attempts. And all the women I know say that those figures are actually very low and that the actual figures approach unity. Much, much higher. And so first off, it's very significant for a guy to say, oh, God, I don't see any violence, whereas it would be much less likely for a woman to say that. I said, do we even need to talk about sweatshops? He's like, no, I get it. And I said, okay, let's keep going. I'm just wondering, do you pay rent? And he's like, yeah. I said, why? And he said, because I don't own? I said, no. What would happen if you didn't pay rent? And he said, I guess I'd get evicted. And I said, I don't know what that means. What would happen if you got evicted? He said, well, the sheriff would come to my house and he'd... I said, stop right there. Okay, so what would happen if when the sheriff came to your house, you said, hey, it's dinner time and I was just making dinner. Why don't you come on in? So you invite him in for dinner. And you feed him. You don't poison him. And you say, after dinner, you say, you know, your company's been kind of pleasant, but not really all that pleasant. So this is my home, and since dinner's over, I'd like for you to leave. You feed him a bunch of donuts. And what would happen then? He said, well, sheriff would say, you didn't pay your rent, so I'm here to evict you. And he'd pull out a gun, and he'd take me away. I said, ah, so the reason you pay rent is because if you don't, some guy with a gun's going to come and kick you out of your home. Like, I don't get it. I said, okay, let's try this again. Let's say you're really hungry, and you go to the grocery store, and you just start eating. There's a lot of food there, you know? I said, what had happened? He said, well, they'd call the sheriff, and he'd come and said, yeah, same guy, right? He's a real asshole, isn't he? said, she'd come and take me away. I said, oh, okay, so if you don't pay somebody to sleep, and then if you don't pay somebody so you can eat, somebody with a gun's going to come and do something bad to you. So there are a few reasons that we don't see the violence that this whole culture is based on. One of them is that we're so fully metabolized into the system that we don't see how crazy it is that you have to pay probably some distant corporation so you can eat. And if you don't pay him, some guy with a gun is going to come. Another reason we don't see a lot of the violence is because a lot of it is exported. I was doing a talk in Massachusetts a couple years ago, and afterwards this one guy said, you know, you talk about how this culture isn't sustainable, but we're living way more sustainably now than we were 100 years ago. I'm like, what? And he said, well, look around. Look at all the trees. And it's like, I don't see any fucking trees. What are you talking about? He said, no, outside, silly. And I said, well, the reason there's more trees now is because you get your wood from South America and you get your food from Iowa. Well, and maybe New York. And so there are a lot of farms. There used to be a lot of farms in Massachusetts, and now they're growing up, and there's, in between the suburbs, there are more of these small forests. So one reason there are more trees there now is because that violence of agriculture and importing wood is exported to somewhere else. Okay, so that's premise three. Premise four. Oh, this is one of my favorite ones. This culture is based on a clearly defined and widely accepted, yet often unarticulated hierarchy. Violence done by those higher on the hierarchy to those lower is nearly always invisible, unnoticed. When it is noticed, it's fully rationalized. Violence done by those lower on the hierarchy to those higher is unthinkable. And when it does happen, it's met with shock, horror, and the fetishization of the victims. And this happens so many, there's just so many examples of this. One example from my own family is that my family was extremely abusive when I was a child. My father was very violent. My brother has epilepsy from blows to the head. He broke my sister's arm. He raped my mother, my sister, and me. And the one time that my brother fought back, he was beaten far worse than any other time because he had sent violence up the hierarchy. He had committed blasphemy. So that's a really good example. What's another example? Bears. Do you have a lot of bears here? There's tons of bears where I live. I see them all the time. There's like every day. There are some, oh, it's so cute. My mom has a great relationship with several generations of bears now. And there's a mother who brings her babies. She brought her babies like first day out of the den. And it's just so cute to see them, you know, wrestling around and standing up on hind legs, boxing and everything. And there's lots of other bears around all the time. Like one day my mom woke up and she saw this other bear standing outside her window, mooning her. I have no idea what message it was sending. Anyway, so the point is that a lot of people, you know, I walk through the forest all the time at night, and people are like, oh my God, there's bears there. Aren't you afraid? You're going to get eaten by a bear. It's so scary. And what I know is that there is one human dies in North America every 2 years from bear attacks. And on the other hand, there are about 44,000 Americans die every year in automobile crashes. So we're afraid of the wrong thing. It's like you should walk through a forest going do-do-do-do, and then you walk through a fucking parking lot. It's like, oh my God, you know? All these cars, like, we're going to get you. What's another example? Oh, Jesus. You know, I live about 3 miles from the ocean, and you know how often I get in? Never. You know why? That fucking movie Jaws. You know? I saw that when I was in high school also, and the acting is also really good in that one. And but every time I get within about a quarter mile of the ocean, I start hearing that theme music, you know? It's like I put in one toe, and like there's gonna be this huge fucking great white come after and pull me into the water. And but what I know also is that the ratio of human attacks on sharks to shark attacks on humans is literally 20 million to one. What's another example? Cops. Every day in the United States, between 4 and 6 people die because they encounter police. Every day in the United States. That's through beatings, shootings, high-speed chases, and medical neglect in prisons and jails. And on the other hand, every time a cop dies, there's this big state funeral, you know. All gave some. The bumper stickers say all gave some gave all. You know, it's a big, big state funeral. And you know what the most dangerous civil service profession is? Garbage collection. It's like 20 times more dangerous than being a cop because you're hanging around with these big fucking trucks that want to kill you, you know? And when was the last time you saw a state funeral for a garbage collector? Or when was the last time you saw, you know, a Tom Cruise movie where he's this intrepid garbage man that's going to clean up the mean streets of L.A., you know? It's not going to happen. Okay, and if you don't believe me, it's like I see a couple people like, yeah, whatever, I don't know if I believe this. Just think about this. Try this little thought experiment. Next time there's like some anti-war protest or some sort of anti-globalization protest or something, go take a baseball bat. And then walk up and say, excuse me, Officer Friendly. This is nothing personal. I'm just doing a little experiment. And then hit him. And then hit him a couple more times real fast. And I'll talk to you in about 20 years. Oh, here's another example. There's a woman in Oklahoma a few years ago who got beaten to death by her husband. And for that, he was sentenced to 7.5 years in prison. As he was going through the judicial process, he spat on a cop. And for that, he was sentenced to life in prison. That's how it should be, you know. It's like irony, irony. I don't want to get beaten up by a bunch of angry women on the way out. But that couldn't happen anyway because that's violence going up the hierarchy. So, ha, it's not going to happen. It's unthinkable. You didn't even hear it. Didn't think of it. Let's see. What's another example? You know, maybe it's safe for me to give this example this close to New York City now. This wouldn't have been safe a couple years ago. But 9/11. You know, when was the last time there was a politician give a speech in which they didn't mention 9/11? It's like 9/10. And there were 3,000 people died in that attack. But there are 500,000 children die every year as a direct result of so-called debt repayment from the so-called non-industrialized nations to the industrialized nations. So if there are between 4 and 6 people dying in the United States every day because they encounter cops, that would be, let's see, 5 times 365 is, let's call it 1,500 to make the math easy. So every 2 years, there are the same number of people killed by cops as were killed in those attacks. There are 15,000 Americans die every 2 weeks from preventable cancers. But those don't seem to count. Let's see, or there's 6,000 people die every year in the United States because of unsafe working conditions. No, 60,000. 6,000. 60,000. 600,000. 600,000. 6 million. 60,000. Every person in the United States dies every year. So I'll give one more example of the whole premise for violence only flows down thing. Does anybody mind if I swear?
Now you ask.
I think that the word fuck is the most amazing word in the English language. It's an extraordinary word because it's all of patriarchy condensed to 4 letters. I find it absolutely extraordinary that the same word that means make love to means do great violence to. That is really messed up. It's also really confusing because somebody can say to me, so I'm going to fuck you. I'm like, I need more information. So the way that ties to the fourth premise is that once again, I think it's really disturbing that the same word that means make love to means do great violence to, that conflation of sex and violence I find extremely disturbing. And then also, it helps me understand homophobia, which is something I never understood, frankly, before then. Because it always seemed to me that if you don't like a homosexual, you probably shouldn't date one, you know? But suddenly I understood this. It was actually a few years ago. Remember the whole Clinton don't ask, don't tell thing where you can't be, you can be homosexual, but you can't talk about it if you're in the military, which means, I guess you can still do it, I have to say, by the way, full disclosure, I have to be absolutely honest about this, that I actually agree that homosexuals should not be allowed into the U.S. military. I'm sorry. But then again, that probably means less than otherwise could, because I also think that heterosexuals, asexuals, transgendered, bisexuals should not be allowed in the U.S. military either. except, what would happen if they each one had their own army? It's like the bisexual brigade to the rescue or something. It'd be kind of fun. Anyway, so I never understood homophobia until I put it together with this whole premise four thing and then also sex and violence being conflated, because suddenly I understood that there's a great line by Catherine McKinnon. Man fucks woman, subject, verb, object. Man fucks woman, subject, verb, object. And to show how deep the objectification of women runs in this culture, think about this. Even within the context of a loving heterosexual relationship, it's really hard not to linguistically objectify the woman. So a man and a woman are together, and the man says to the woman, "I would like to be inside of you." What just happened? She's the object of the sentence. Okay, so the woman says to the man, "I would like for you to be inside me." You know what happens? She's still the object of the sentence. Okay, so now the man, he's going to be all groovy and feminist and everything. And so what he says is, "I would like for you to be around me." And she's like, "I think I'm willing, but I don't really understand." Anyway, so what does, you know, the man fucks woman inside of her object. I suddenly understood the whole homophobia thing, because what that means is when sex and violence get conflated, which I think is absurd in the first place, but when sex and violence get conflated, and then violence can only flow down, which means sex can only flow down, that means that you have to have a fucker and a fuckee. And the fuckee has to be lower on the scale. And so that's where the homophobia comes in, is because if the fucker and the fuckee are on the same level, then all the little tiny brains they just seize up. I think I've kind of beaten that one to death. Okay, so if I'm beating an idea to death, does that mean that the violence... Okay. Fifth premise. The property of those higher on the hierarchy is more valuable than the lives of those below. It is acceptable for those above to increase the amount of property they control, in everyday language, to make money, by destroying or taking the lives of those below. This is called production. If those below damage the property of those above may kill or otherwise destroy the lives of those above. This is called justice. I love that one. Sixth premise. This culture is not redeemable. The culture will not undergo any sort of voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living. If we don't put a halt to it, this culture will continue to immiserate the vast majority of humans and to degrade the planet until it, civilization, and probably the planet, collapses. The effects of this degradation will continue to harm humans and non-humans for a very long time. Seventh premise. The longer we wait for civilization to crash, or the longer we wait before we ourselves bring it down, the messier will be the crash, and the worse things will be for those humans and non-humans who live during it, and for those who come after. The longer we wait, the worse things are going to be. If somebody would have brought down civilization 200 years ago, if Tecumseh would have won, then the people who live here would still be able to eat passenger pigeons. If people would have brought it down 100 years ago, people in the Northwest could still eat salmon, even excluding salmon's wonderful existence for themselves, just on a level of calories. If somebody would have brought it down 100 years ago, there would be no dioxin in mother's breast milk. We wouldn't really have to worry about global warming. The oceans would still be alive. There would be no plastic in the oceans. If somebody would have brought it down 100 years ago, we wouldn't have to worry about Fox News. He's gone. Let's see. I mean, how bad does it have to get? You know, are people 50 years from now going to be going, you know, if someone brought it down 50 years ago, there'd still be great apes. There would still be migratory songbirds. There would still be fish. There would still be oceans. You know, at what point... how bad does it have to get? Eighth premise. The needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of the economic system. The needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of the economic system. I have just guaranteed I will never hold public office. Another way to put the eighth premise is, any economic or social system that doesn't benefit the natural communities on which it's based is unsustainable, immoral, and really stupid. Sustainability, morality, and intelligence require the dismantling of any such economic or social system, or at the very least, disallowing it from damaging your land base. I mean, what do all of the so-called solutions to global warming have in common? What they all have in common is that they take the economic system as primary, as a given, and the natural world as secondary. And that's insane. Oh, I was doing this terrible interview a couple years ago. This guy, it was a radio interview for this right-wing anti-environmental, property rights, uber alles, Bible thumper. And I kept saying, you know, 90% of large fish in the oceans are gone, all the plastic in the oceans, dioxin, everyone's breast milk. He kept saying the same thing to me, which is, okay, that's all fine, Derek, but let's get back in the real world. I thought that was the real world. And what I realized is that for him, the real world is industrial capitalism. And I realized also that that's how a lot of people use that language. I mean, honestly, a lot of people are in college. I mean, have you ever heard any friends say, what are you going to do when you get out in the real world? And what that really means is, what are you going to do when you have to get a fucking job? You know, when you have to enter a life of painful employment. But, you know, what am I going to do when I get out in the real world? I'm going to roll around in the dirt. That's what I'm going to do. You know, that's the real world. And we, you know, we don't get that. You know, the real world is Wall Street or all that. That's not the real world. Those are all... What people don't seem to understand, so many people, is that without a real world, you don't have a social system, which means any social system must be secondary to the real world. And I'll tell you something else about this interview, which is that I'm not nearly as smart as my books make me seem, because one of the great things about being a writer is that you get to win every argument. And so what happens, the way the books really work, is that I'll call up a friend, and the friend will say something really smart, and then in the books, the way it goes is, you know, my friend says something smart, I say something smart, my friend says something smart, I say something smart. It's like, oh my God, we're both so smart. And then the way it goes in real life is, my friend says something really smart, and I say, damn. It's like, that's really smart. And then I call him back in about a month, and then I've got this, you know, really smart response I've figured out over the last month, and then they say something really smart right back, and it's like, okay, I'll call you in a month. And, and that's what happened with that interview, that the last question the guy asked me was, he said, you know, it's very clear, Derek, that you don't have an appreciation for the fact that God gave man dominion over the earth. And my answer was really tepid. It was like, well, if you attempt to express dominion over something, that means you're not going to have a relationship with it, and you're going to end up destroying it, blah, 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 you know, whatever. It was a terrible response. And then that night, about 2 a.m, I came up with a response. I was so excited, I just want to call him and say, here's my response. What I wish I would have said, his name was Andy, what I wish I would have said is, you know, actually I do have a great appreciation for the fact that God gave man dominion over the earth. In fact, just last night I was talking to God, and God said, you know, Derek, when I gave man dominion over the earth, I was not specific enough. And what I really meant is, I'm giving you, Derek, dominion over the earth. And in fact, I'm especially giving you, Derek, dominion over everyone named Andy. So what this means, Andy, is that anything that's yours, me and my fellow Derekistians get to come take. And he would have said, it doesn't say that in the Bible. And I would have said, I can't help it if you read the wrong Bible. Okay. So, the eighth premise. Ninth premise is, I gotta tell you another digression, which is that I can talk about anything I want. You know, I can bash capitalism, I can bash corporations, I can bash environmentalists, I can bash Christianity anywhere but here, evidently. Oh good God, that's not a word I'm gonna say again. Onward, Christian. That didn't work either. Okay, so I lost a lot of social capital there. Okay, anyway, so I can bash all this stuff. You know, I can bash environmentalists, I can bash anarchists, I can bash anarchists who bash environmentalists, I can bash environmentalists who bash anarchists who bash environmentalists, I can bash all this stuff. It doesn't matter. Nobody cares. But there are three things I can't bash for tonight. There are three things I can't bash. I can't bash science. What I found is, if I start to bash science, I can just feel all the sphincters in the audience start to quiver. The other thing I can't bash, I can't bash Buddhism. It's like, you can't say you've lived until you've been chased down the street by a bunch of angry pacifists. And the third thing I can't bash is, I can't talk about overpopulation. Because as soon as you start saying there are too many people on the planet for what the planet can support, people go, you must not like babies. The truth is, I actually don't like babies. Except for this really good barbecue sauce out of Kansas City. It's a joke. There are more people on the planet than the planet can support. Someday there will be far fewer people than there are now. And that said, I don't think the population is a primary problem. I think the population is actually a tertiary problem. The reason I think population is a secondary problem instead of a primary problem is that, yes, there are more people on the planet can support, but I think that overconsumption is a bigger problem, because actually numbers don't mean anything at all. You could have 100 gazillion people on the planet, and if they didn't eat, shit, or stand anywhere, it wouldn't matter. The point is how much harm you cause. And this is really important, because when I think of overpopulation, the first thing I think of is some impoverished child with a big distended belly living in Mexico City. And when I think of overconsumption, the first thing I think of is somebody from Canada, actually. Did you know they have a higher per capita energy uses and resource usage in Canada than in the United States? It's not our fault. So the first thing I think of is one of those frickin' Canadians. The first thing I think of is somebody in the industrialized nations. And who causes more harm to the planet? You know, a subsistence farmer in India or somebody who lives within an industrialized nation? And it's pretty obvious who causes more problems. That's why I talk about overconsumption. Well, I'm not saying there aren't more people on the planet can support. And humans have exceeded carrying capacity. Everybody know what carrying capacity is? Carrying capacity is the number of any given species who can live in one area forever without harming a land base. And forever is the key word, because you can have 1,000 deer, you can have an island that has a carrying capacity of 1,000 deer, and 1,000 deer can live there forever. But if you put 10,000 deer there, they're going to eat too much, they're going to denude the landscape, and it's going to permanently reduce carrying capacity. So you can temporarily exceed it. But what you're going to have happen is what we're seeing now. Oh, and by the way, everybody says, you know, there's no such thing as a stupid question. I got one. I'm going to share it with you. Which is, I was on this, there's this radio program I sometimes do one county south of where I live, Humboldt County in Northern California. And there's this guy who hates me so much that every time I'm on there, he calls up and he'll just sputter. I can't tell what he's saying because he's usually so mad he doesn't make any sense. And one time I was saying that humans have exceeded carrying capacity, and he called up just sputtering and said, "How dare you say that humans have exceeded their capacity to care?" Thank you so much for sharing. So the reason I think the population is not a secondary problem but a tertiary problem, yes, humans have exceeded carrying capacity, but the reason I think it's a tertiary problem is because, are there any demographers in here? Good. I hate demographers. Kidding. The reason I hate demographers is that they sometimes talk about something called a natural rate of population increase, which is you have X number of people and then Y number of years, and then there's this exponential growth. Well, that presumes that people breed like rabbits. But the truth is, I don't even think rabbits breed like rabbits. I think that people, including rabbit people, make rational family planning decisions based upon your personal and social circumstances. And what that means is, like, okay, the Talawa, who, once again, I live on Talawa land, and they lived there for 12,500 years, they had a steady state population. They didn't have this population increase going on forever. And there are a number of reasons for that. One of them is, did you know that the native North Americans used, I think it's like 250 different plants as contraceptives and abortifacients? 250 different ones. And the decisions to use those were made by the women. What a bunch of fucking primitives. Back about the whole thing about making rational family planning decisions. I don't know if you know this. It's very interesting. Do you know if you put worms in a worm bin and you limit their food supply, they will limit the number of babies they have. And they don't even have a brain. Just thought I'd mention that. Oh, I got to tell you a story, too, that anthropologists, maybe 130 years ago, you know, primarily male-dominated field, they went out, they wanted to know what some indigenous peoples used for contraceptives. And so the male anthropologists went out, and they talked to the men, because, of course, the men are the only ones we're talking to. And the men said, "How do we not have babies?" "It's a secret." And then a few years later, some female anthropologists went to the same people, and they went and asked the women, "How do you not have babies?" And the women said, "Well, when you're 16, if you don't want to conceive, if when you're 16, you eat this certain root, it makes you sterile for 5 years. And then after that, if you do want to conceive, you eat this root. And if you don't want to conceive still, you eat this root." And the men are like, "Really? I had no idea." Anyway, so population is actually a tertiary problem because it's based upon, if you have, I mean, picture this, you have a way of life in which all the mythologies are cyclical, and you have an intimate relationship with the land, and you're planning on living there forever, and your family planning decisions are going to be different than if you are consuming land bases, if you have an economy based on growth, and you have a religion based on growth, and you have somebody writes a Bible, or somebody writes a book in which they say that you should go forth and multiply, and this book becomes a really big bestseller, then you're going to make different rational family planning decisions. So the cultural belief that the world doesn't exist for real, and the cultural belief that you can multiply indefinitely, affects your family planning decisions. Okay, so that finally gets us to the ninth premise, which is that although there will clearly someday be far fewer humans than there are at present, there are many ways this reduction in population could occur. Some of the ways would be characterized by extreme violence and privation. Nuclear Armageddon, for example, would certainly reduce both population and consumption, yet would do so horrifically. Same would be true for a continuation overshoot followed by crash. Other ways would not be so violent, and personally and collectively, we may be able to both reduce the amount and soften the character of violence that occurs through the shift, or we may not. But this much is certain. Here's the premise. If we don't approach it actively, if we don't talk about our predicament and what we're going to do about it, the violence will almost undoubtedly be far more severe and the privation more extreme. So the ninth premise basically is we're in a bad way, and if we don't talk about it, it's going to get worse. And once again, every cell in my body wants for us to have a voluntary transformation. If I ran for president, I would run on a platform of vasectomies on the house, you know? And, I already have a campaign slogan ready. You ready? A sniff in every sack. They liked it in Hamilton. I think I might get a fair amount of the female vote if I run on that platform. Okay, 10th premise. Oh, what I was saying is that every cell in my body wants for this to be a voluntary transformation, but I don't think it's going to happen. 10th premise. The culture as a whole and most of its members are insane. The culture is driven by a death urge and urge to destroy life. The culture as a whole and most of its members are insane. We don't need to talk about that, do we? I don't know if this happens to you, but sometimes I'll be doing something else and a vision of Angelina Jolie will appear before me. And she'll just stand suspended in space. It makes me happy. It kind of makes me nervous though. Because I was reading the other day that she and Brad are in trouble. It's very bad. I mean, because, oh my God, it just occurred to me. I didn't even think about this before. Oh, shit. If she breaks up with Brad, okay, he might go back with Jen, which would be okay. But if she gets back with Billy Bob, I don't know what I'm going to do. Did you know when they were together, when Billy Bob and her were together, did you know they each had a vial of the other's blood around their neck? And do you know where she had his name tattooed? Oh, my God, I'll bet she was wishing his name was Ed. Speaking of genitals, did you know that Nicole Kidman does not like to wear underwear? I read that in the newspaper, so it must be true. Whose land is this? Who? Here? And what's the name for this place? What's the indigenous name for this place? Does anybody know the indigenous name for this place? No, this place right here. This particular place. I find it is insane in terms of being out of touch with physical reality that I can tell you what at one point was on Angelina Jolie's genitals and what is not on Nicole Kidman's genitals, which will never affect my own personal life, I guarantee. But it took me several years to find out the indigenous name for the place where I live, or to find out that there was a massacre of about 250 Indians about 2 miles from where I live at a place called Yontaket, and another massacre of at a place called Hawanket, another massacre at a place called Atchula, all within about 4 or 5 miles of my home. And it took me years to find that out. I mean, it is insane that I can tell you that Manny Ramirez has been smoking the whole National League since he went over. But I can't name 10 species of edible plants and fungi within 100 yards of my home. That's, okay, let's try it. Let's see, there is blackberry. There's two types of blackberry. I'm going to need them. Himalayan and native. There is huckleberry, salal, thimbleberry, salmonberry. Chanterelles, blackberries, and I know another edible one. You know those big red mushrooms with the white dots? You know, there's 2 million dams in this country, and I was thinking that if I ate one of those mushrooms, I could take out a dam all by myself. I could take out a dam with one finger.
Osoberry.
I'm sorry?
Osoberry. Indian plum.
Is that in Northern California? Mm-hmm. Huh. I'll look those up when I get home. Thank you. See, this guy knows more about where I live than I do.
They're not needed. They're very toxic. That's really bad advice.
It's
not needed. No. It was my joke about the red. It's a joke. Okay, 11th premise. From the beginning, this culture has been a culture of occupation. And the government is a government of occupation. And when I talk about this, a lot of my American Indian friends say, what took you so long to figure this one out? What does a government of occupation do? A government of occupation moves in and it attempts to maximize resource extraction and maximize production. What does the U.S. government do? It attempts to facilitate resource extraction and maximize production. That's what it does, and not care about communities. And so I want to read something very brief about it being a culture of occupation. Wrong one. Oh, shoot, I'm going to go back. I'm sorry, I forgot this. I'm going to go back and talk about something about population, because it's very important. And I left off something very important about the fact that someday there will be far fewer people than there are now. And it raises a really important point, which is that one of the things I talk about a lot is bringing down civilization. And something we shouldn't skip over at all is that when civilization comes down, there's going to be a lot of people die. And so sometimes people will say, well, you can't bring down civilization because a lot of people are going to die. And there's a bunch of answers to that. The first one is, which people are you talking about? Are you talking about salmon people? Are you talking about polar bear people? Are you talking about tiger people? If you were to ask polar bears if they think we should bring down civilization, they would say, yep. If you ask salmon people if we should bring down civilization, they would say, what's taking you so long? But you know what? They're just non-humans, so fuck them, right? Well, a few years ago, I was talking to a friend of mine, Anuradha Mittal, who's a former director of Food First, and I said, so if the global economy disappeared tomorrow, would the people of India be better off? And she laughed and said, of course. There are former granaries of India that now export dog food and tulips to Western Europe. There are people who are being forced off, subsistence farmers who are being forced off their land. Would the subsistence farmers who are being forced off their land, would they be better off if the global economy disappeared tomorrow? Of course they would. So the urban poor, many of them would be better off immediately. The urban rich, the rural poor would be better off immediately. The rural rich, they got guns, they'll be fine. The urban poor are fucked. And the urban poor, as civilization crashes, are going to be even more fucked. And I'm not saying that lightly. We've been painted into a corner. And every cell in my body wants for us to have a voluntary transformation, but I don't see it happening. But I'm not sure that actually all the urban poor would be fucked, because especially in non-industrialized nations, you want to talk about instant land reform, stop the flow of U.S. arms to the rich in those countries, and we're going to have instant land reform. We're in a very, very bad way. It's the whole point about that. And so the question is, you know, what are we going to do about the fact that no matter what we do, we're complicit of mass murder, really? Because if we don't act, we're participating in mass murder. If we don't bring down this culture, if we don't stop the U.S. invasion of, you know, Iran, whatever country we want to put on the list, we're complicit in mass murder. But if we stop, we're complicit in mass murder. What do you do with that? And I finally have an answer I'm really happy with, which is, if you've gotten this far in this book, or if you're simply anything other than entirely insensate, we probably agree that civilization is going to crash, whether or not we help bring it about. If you don't agree with this, we probably have nothing to say to each other. Oh, how about them Cubbies? Man, they're doing great this year. We probably also agree that the crash will be messy. We agree further that since industrial civilization is systematically dismantling the ecological infrastructure of the planet, the sooner civilization comes down, whether or not we help it crash, the more life will remain afterwards to support both humans and non-humans. If you agree with this, and if you don't want to dirty your spirituality and conscience with the physical work of helping to bring down civilization, and if your primary concern really is for the well-being of those humans who will be alive during and immediately after the crash, then given, and I repeat this point to emphasize it, the civilization's going to come down anyway, you need to start preparing people for the crash. Instead of coming to my talks and attacking me for stating the obvious, go rip up asphalt and vacant parking lots to convert them to neighborhood gardens. Go teach people how to identify local edible plants, even in the city, especially in the city. So these people won't starve when the proverbial shit hits the fan, they can no longer head off to Albertsons for groceries. Set up committees to eliminate or, if appropriate, channel the additional violence that might break out. We need it all. We need people to take out dams, and we need people to knock out electrical infrastructures. By the way, I mentioned before there's 2 million dams in the United States. There's 2 million dams, 60,000 dams over 13 feet tall, 70,000 dams over 6.5 feet tall. A lot of times people say, God, Derek, you're so militant, you're so non-compromising. Well, if we only took out one dam a day, it would take 200 years to take out all those 70,000 dams. And salmon don't have that time. Sturgeon don't have that time. So here's my compromise. 5 dams a day, 40 years. Done deal. We need people to protest and to chain themselves to trees. We also need people working to ensure that as many people as possible are equipped to deal with the fallout when the collapse comes. We need people working to teach others what wild plants to eat, what plants are natural antibiotics. We need people teaching others how to purify water, how to build shelters. All this can look like supporting traditional local knowledge. It can look like starting rooftop gardens. It can look like planting local varieties of medicinal herbs. And it can look like teaching people how to sing. The truth is that, although I do not believe that designing groovy eco-villages will help bring down civilization, when the crash comes, I'm sure to be first in line knocking on their doors asking for food. People taking out dams do not have a responsibility to ensure that people in homes previously powered by hydro know how to cook over a fire. They do, however, have a responsibility to support the people doing that work. Similarly, those people growing medicinal plants in preparation for the end of civilization do not have a responsibility to take out dams. They do, however, have a responsibility at the very least to not condemn those people who've chosen that work. In fact, they have a responsibility to support them. They especially have a responsibility to not report them to the cops. It's the same old story. The good thing about everything being so fucked up is that no matter where you look, there's great work to be done. Do what you love, do what you can, do what best serves your land base. We need it all. That doesn't mean that everybody taking out dams and everybody working to cultivate medicinal plants are working toward the same goals. It does mean that if they are, each should see the importance of the other's work. Further, resistance needs to be global. Acts of resistance are more effective when they're large-scale and coordinated. The infrastructure is monolithic and centralized, so common tools and techniques can be used to dismantle it in many different places, simultaneously if possible. By contrast, the work of renewal must be local. To be truly effective, acts of survival and livelihood need to grow from particular land bases where they'll thrive. People need to enter into conversation with each piece of earth and all its human and non-human inhabitants. That doesn't mean, of course, that we can't share ideas that one water purification technique won't be useful in many different locations. It does mean that people in those places need to decide for themselves what will work. Most important of all, the water in each place needs to be asked and allowed to decide for itself. So now I want to read. I'll let you know where we're at. Where the hell's the other paper? Oh, here it is. Okay, what I'd like to do now is read a short thing about culture of occupation, and then do one more premise, and then talk about that premise for a minute, and then bash hope for a couple minutes, and then read two very short things. Okay? Just so we're clear. Okay, the culture of occupation stuff. If Nazis or other fascists took over North America, what would we all do? What would we do if they implemented Mussolini's definition of fascism? Fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism because it's a merger of state and corporate power. What if anti-government activity, oops, what if the occupied country called itself a democracy, but most everyone understood elections to be shams? Was citizens allowed to choose between different wings of the same fascist or following Mussolini corporate party? What if, just out of curiosity, how many people believe we live in a democracy? That many, eh? In an election year, no less. How many people believe that the U.S. government cares more for the rights and well-being of individual human beings than corporations? That many, huh? Okay, what if this occupied country called itself a democracy, but most everyone understood elections to be shams? Was citizens allowed to choose between different wings of the same fascist or following Mussolini corporate party? What if anti-government activity was opposed by stormtroopers and secret police? Would you fight back? If there already existed a resistance movement, would you join it? Now, would you resist if the fascists irradiated the countryside, poisoned food supplies, made rivers unfit for swimming, and so filthy you wouldn't even dream of drinking from them anymore? You know, people used to drink from rivers. How quaint is that? What if they did this because, hell, I can't finish that sentence because no matter how I try, I can't come up with a motivation good enough even for fascists to irradiate and toxify landscape and water supplies. If fascists systematically deforested the continent, would you join an underground army of resistance? Head to the forest and from there to boardrooms and to the halls of the Reichstag to pick off the occupying deforesters, most especially those who give them their marching orders. I mean, what if what we do is space aliens came down from outer, that's where they come from, if aliens came down from outer space and they started to systematically deforest the planet and they were vacuuming the oceans and they put dioxin in every mother's breast milk and they were just systematically, you know, killing off everything or changing the climate, these space aliens, what would we do? I mean, I know we'd grab our camo outfits, we'd grab our AK-47s, and we'd wrong audience. So am I the only person here with an AK-47? I shared the stage with Ward Churchill a while back, and he was in the audience when I was doing my talk, and I did the same joke about, am I the only person here with an AK-47? The place was just silent, and then I hear one voice go, nope. Oh, and then another time, I did a talk in western Pennsylvania, and I said, so am I the only person here with an AK-47? I got to tell you, about half the people in the audience raised their hands. I'm just saying. Okay, or what would we do? What would we do if the Iraqis had invaded the United States? You know, they were this close to invading. Okay, so maybe your sense of kin and your sense of skin doesn't extend to the natural world. Maybe you don't yet love the land where you live enough that you fight for it. But what if the fascists toxify not only the landscape, but the bodies of those you love? What if their actions put dioxin and dozens of other carcinogens into the flesh of your lover, children, mother, brother, sister, father? Would you fight back? How many people in here have had someone you love die of cancer? It's like 75%. And you know, of course, that cancer is caused in great measure by the toxification of the total environment. Oh, sorry, no, it's caused by a cancer gene. So would you fight back? What if the fascists toxify your own body? Would you still cling to the illusion that their edicts carry more weight than that brought to bear by their secret and not-so-secret police? Would you work for the regime? Would you teach others its virtues? Or would you fight back? If you won't fight back when they toxify your own body, when precisely will you fight back? Give me, and more importantly yourself, a specific threshold which you finally take a stand. If you can or won't give the threshold, why not? None of these questions are rhetorical. The questions are real. They are, at this point, some of the most important questions there are. Okay, so once again, what I'd like to do now is one more premise, and then talk about that premise for a minute, and then bash hope, and then read two very short things. Okay, 15th premise is, skip the runs in between. 15th premise, love does not imply pacifism. One of the reasons that I wrote Endgame is because when I would do talks about fighting back, so often the response by the audience was fairly predictable. and that's a lot of sort of mainstream environmentalists and a lot of peace and social justice activists would put up what I've taken to calling Gandhi shields, which is they would say the names Gandhi, Martin Luther King, and Dalai Lama again and again real fast to keep all evil thoughts at bay. And then grassroots environmentalists would a lot of times do the same thing, but then afterwards they would come up to me and they'd whisper in my ear, "Thank you so much for bringing this up." And then when I would talk to other groups of people, the response was entirely different. And other groups might be survivors of domestic violence, a lot of people of color, especially American Indians, gang kids, the very poor, family farmers, a lot of radical environmentalists. When I would talk about fighting back with them, they would look at me like, "Tell us something we don't know. Let's go, bro." And it took me a while to figure out what the difference was. And what the difference is for those latter groups, oftentimes, when you've suffered violence directly in your own body, it's no longer a theoretical or abstract or spiritual question to be puzzled through. It's just a fact of life, and you deal with it. Doesn't mean you participate, and it doesn't mean you don't. But it means you deal with it. You don't. It's not some capital V violence question. It's just a part of life. And what are you going to do? And so what I wanted to do is I wanted to write a pamphlet that would answer some of the sort of cliched comments. I mean, I wish, classic cliche. I wish I had a dime for every time somebody said you can't use the master's tools to dismantle the master's house, or throw out these standard lines are thrown out all the time. And I got so tired of answering them, I wanted to just write this pamphlet that would answer those specific cliches. And the next time I got them, it's like, "Here, go away." And that, as you've seen with the way I talk tonight, turned into an 1,100-page book. And so I want to go through just a couple, three of the cliches. One of them is the one I just, there's the love does not imply pacifism. So often people have said to me, "Derek, you talk about fighting back, and you talk about an enemy, you talk about corporations being an enemy, you talk about the CEOs being an enemy, and that's just dualistic, and dualism is bad." And so I would say, so what you're saying is non-dualism good, dualism bad? Checkmate. Or they would say, if you just love enough, we have to love the CEOs enough, and then, I don't know what will happen, but something good. And if you just loved enough, you would never talk about fighting back. Well, I grew up in the country, and in my life, I have been attacked by mother horses, cows, dogs, cats, chickens, ducks, geese, hawks, eagles, spiders, and mice who thought I was attacking their babies. And if a mother mouse will attack someone 6,000 times her size and win, what the hell's wrong with us? So, love does not imply pacifism, and I think Mother Grizzly Bears will back me up on this one. Actually, I do think that we don't love enough, but I don't think that it's that we don't love, I don't think that we need to love the CEOs more. I think we need to love ourselves more. Because if we loved ourselves, we wouldn't put up with any of this shit. We wouldn't put up with... another cliche, and thank you. Another cliche is you can't use a master's tool to dismantle the master's house. Okay, I love Audre Lorde. She's great. She's wonderful. But I can tell you two things. One is the pacifists who've thrown out you can't use a master's tool to dismantle the master's house have never read the essay from which that comes, because it has nothing to do with pacifism. It has to do with using a multivariate approach to a problem that's multivariate, which is exactly what I'm talking about. The second thing I can tell you is that she never worked construction, because it's a terrible fucking metaphor. Because, honestly, you can use anybody's tools to dismantle the master's house. You can use my tools, you can use your tools, you can use your Uncle Jim's tools, you can steal tools from Walmart. It doesn't matter. And besides which, that question presumes that there's a master's house, and it presumes that violence is one of the master's tools. Well, those in power tell us that they own the land, they tell us they own the water, they tell us they own genetic materials, they tell us they own air, they tell us they own everything. I'll be goddamned if I give them violence too. And I think once again that Mother Grizzly Bears will back me up on this one. What's another cliche that gets thrown out? Let's see, there's that one, there's that one. There's a bunch more, but one, since it's getting late, I'll just do one more for now, unless I think of the other one in a minute. But another one is, I'll do two. Does anybody here have my book, A Language Older Than Words? Okay, do you also have a straight razor at your house? Okay, take the chapter Violence Revisited and cut it out and crimple it up. I was going to say throw it away, but recycle it. Because I say something in there that is so embarrassing. I can't believe I say this. Okay, in that chapter, I say, oh my God, I would rather admit to being a compulsive masturbator, which I'm not. In that chapter, I say that if you fight back, you run the risk of becoming like they are. That is one of the stupidest things that anybody has ever said. Think about it for a second. Does that mean that Tecumseh, by fighting back, ran the risk of becoming like the people who are stealing their land? Does it mean that a woman who kills someone attempting to rape her runs a risk of becoming a rapist? Does that mean that a tiger who kills a zookeeper runs a risk of becoming a zookeeper? It makes no sense. And then the last one is, what I want to mention now, is that people say, you know, violence never accomplishes anything. Really? So what that means is that the reason the Native Americans gave the land to the dominant culture is because when they saw the whites, they said, hey, you want some land? Your way of living is way better than ours. And does that mean that all those people who came over on the Middle Passage, they actually wanted to take eco-tours of the cotton plantations of Mississippi? It means they jumped on the boats and just had really bad travel agents? I mean, what you're saying, if you're saying that violence doesn't accomplish anything, is you're saying that there was no slave trade. What you're saying is that the dominant culture didn't steal the land from the Indians. What you're saying is that there's a great line by Robin Morgan. She says, anywhere in the world, any woman can be walking alone late at night, and if she hears footsteps behind her, she has reason to be afraid. Systematic violence by men against women has fundamentally changed the behavior of half of the human population. I can walk alone late at night, anywhere. I've walked alone late at night in South Central LA. I've walked alone late at night in all over the country. And the only time I was ever afraid is when I was wearing cowboy boots and I couldn't run. But a woman can't say the same thing. Maybe they can, but once again, men's violence against women has systematically changed. And I got to tell you this, if I weren't afraid of state violence, there would not be a dam standing in the Western United States. So don't tell me that violence doesn't accomplish anything. Violence is dreadfully effective. That's why they use it. So, a few years ago, I got a call from a friend of mine who's a long-time grassroots environmental activist, works on toxic issues. She called me up and she was crying. She said, this work's killing me. It's breaking my heart. I said, yeah, I know, it'll do that. She said, you know, the dominant culture hates everything, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does, even itself. She said, has a death urge, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does. She said, unless it stopped, it's going to kill everything on the planet, isn't it? I said, yeah, it is, unless it stopped. She said, we're not going to make some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And I said what I knew was the best thing I could say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason I knew that was the best thing I could say is because about 14 or 15 years ago now, I was undergoing a similar collapse, where I was bursting into sobs several times a week, death of the salmon, sturgeon, bull trout, Kootenai sturgeon, Selkirk caribou. Just all these creatures and places I loved were being destroyed. And I couldn't deal. I was sobbing a lot. A lot of my environmental activist friends were saying, you know, Derek, just take some time off from the work. The work will still be there when you come back. And I knew I couldn't do that. I knew that I had to keep pushing. Because if you're not going to cry about the death of the salmon, what do tears mean? What are you going to cry about? If you're not going to cry about the murder of the oceans, what are you going to cry about? And I just kept pushing, and I kept working on the issues and kept doing the activism and kept crying. And one day I called up a friend of mine, Jeanette Armstrong, who's an Okanagan Indian writer and activist, and I was sobbing. And I said, this work's killing me. It's breaking my heart. And I said, yeah, it'll do that. And I said, the dominant culture hates everything, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does, even itself. And I said, it has a death urge, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does. I said, unless it stops, it's going to kill everything on the planet, isn't it? She said, yeah, it is, unless it stopped. I said, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And she said the best thing she could possibly say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason that was the best thing she could say is because it normalized my despair. And it let me know that despair is an appropriate response to a desperate situation. And it let me know that sorrow is just sorrow, and pain is just pain. And it's not so much the sorrow or even the pain that hurts as it is my resistance to it. And it let me know that I could feel all those things and it wouldn't kill me. There's this idea that if you acknowledge how bad things are, you have to go around being miserable all the time. But the truth is, I'm a complex enough being that I can hold in my heart the understanding that we're really fucked. And that life's really, really good. And that we're really, really fucked. And that life is really, really good. And we're so fucked. And life is so good. And, you know, I am full of sorrow and hate and joy and love and contentment and discontentment and outrage and everything else. We're allowed to feel more than one thing at a time, you know? And so I realized I could feel all those things and it wouldn't kill me. And I realized something else, actually, is I could feel all those things and it would kill me. And there's a wonderful thing about being dead, which is that once you're dead, they can't touch you anymore. You can still sing and you can still dance and you can still fight and you can still make love. And they can't touch you. There's a great poem by the Zen poet Bunan, which is, die while you're alive and be absolutely dead. Then do whatever you want. It's all good. One of the smartest things that the Nazis did was they made it so that at every step of the way it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist. Do you want to get an ID card or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to move to a ghetto or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to get on a cattle car or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to take a shower? Or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? At every step of the way, it was in their rational best interest to not resist. As Zygmunt Bauman says, rational people will go quietly, meekly to a gas chamber if only you allow them to believe it's a bathroom. And I would say rational people will go quietly, meekly to the end of the earth if only you allow them to believe that buying compact fluorescents is going to save the day. I'll tell you something very important, going back to the Nazis. Which is that the Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. No, listen. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. One of the things I think that we absolutely need to do is to eradicate false hope. False hopes are what bind us to unlivable situations, and they blind us to real possibilities. One of the reasons my mother stayed with my father is because in the 50s and 60s there weren't battered women's shelters, but another reason she stayed with him is because of the false hope that he would change. What are the false hopes that tie us to the system? Does anybody really think that if Barack wins the election that things are going to be okay? Does anybody really think that if the Democrats just take over the House and Senate that maybe the war in Iraq will end? Oh, sorry. You know, what are the false hopes that keep you tied in? We need to ruthlessly eradicate false hopes. But the problem is not only false hopes, but hope itself. I was doing a talk in Colorado a few years ago, and someone in the audience shouted out, I was bashing hope, you know, it's such a fun thing to do. And one of the people in the audience shouted out, so what's your definition of hope? I was like, oh God, I got no idea. I've been bashing hope for years. I have no idea what I'm talking about. And so I asked them, so what's your definition of hope? And they came up with a great definition of hope, which is hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. Hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. That's how we use it in everyday language. I don't hope that I eat something tonight. I'm simply going to do it. On the other hand, tomorrow when I get on a plane, I hope it doesn't crash. Because once it's in the air, I have no agency. Well, think about this. Those of you who have children, you know, what would happen if you said to your child, so please clean your room, and your child said, oh, I hope it gets done. Total non-starter. But we use that word all the time. I hope that the oceans survive. I hope that salmon survive. What you're doing when you say you hope salmon survive is you're saying you have no power. You're saying you have no agency. Well, I'll tell you this. I don't hope that coho salmon survive. If they don't like how they're being treated and they want to go away, I will say goodbye and I will... I will miss them. But if they don't want to go away, I will not allow the dominant culture to drive them extinct. I will do whatever it takes, and I mean whatever it takes, to make sure they survive. I do not hope the coho salmon survive. It is customary, when speaking of the apocalypse, to end on a happy note. And I can't really do that, but I'll do my best. And so I want to read two short things. One of them is that... It's actually the most beautiful thing that I've ever written, and I didn't write it. It was written by a stream near my home, by which I don't mean that I wrote it sitting next to the stream. I mean that the stream wrote it. And I've been trying to write about what it's like to be a river for several days, and then I realized that that's a really stupid, you know, it's really stupid for me to try to write about what it's like to be a river when I can simply ask one. That'd be like me trying to write about what it's like to be a woman when I can simply ask you. And so I went down to this stream and I said, what is it like to be you? And the stream had been waiting so long for a human to ask that question. And it gave me the answer right away. And also I realized in that moment that the question, what is it like to be you, is the fundamental question in any relationship, whether it's with a friend, a lover, a non-human, one's home, whatever. The question is, what is it like to be you? And I realized I had never asked anyone that question before, and no one had ever asked me. So I asked the stream, what is it like to be you? And the stream gave me the answer right away. And I went running back into the house as fast as I could to write it down. And meanwhile, the forest was going, what's it like to be me? Hello? So I wrote it down. I didn't even edit it. And this is what the river, the stream and then the forest said. And then one more piece after this, very, very, very short. Pretend you're a river. Pretend you are the mist who falls so fine, so gentle, that nothing separates water and air. You're the rain who falls in sheets, explodes onto the ground to leave pox and puddles. You're the ground who receives the water, soaking it up, taking it in, carrying it deep inside. You're the cracks and fissures where the waters accumulate, flow, fall to join more water and more, and pools and rivers who move slowly through cavities, crevices, pores. You're the sounds and silence of water seeping or staying still. You're the meeting of wet and dry, the union of liquid and solid, where solids dissolve and liquids solidify. You're the pressure who pushes water through seams. You're the rushing water who bubbles from the earth. You're a tiny pool between rocks. You overflow, find your way to join others who, like you, are moving, moving. You're the air at the surface of the water, the joining of substantial and insubstantial, the union of under and over, weight and not weight. You're the riffle, the rapid, the tiny waterfall who turns water to air and air to water. You're the mist who settles on the soil. You're the plants who drink the mist. And you're the sun who warms and feeds them. You're the fish who feed on insects, who feed on plants, who feed on soils, who feed on fish. You're the fish who become soils, who become plants, who become insects, who become fish, who flow down the river. You're the river who joins other rivers to become a new river, who's all the rivers and something else. You are the river. You do not stop at the banks where liquid turns to solid. You reach into the sky and into the soil. Water moves through rocks, comes up to form pools far from the fast flow where the rivers move together, seeps down to join still waters deep below the surface, waters who sleep and wake and sleep and mingle with the stones who are the river too. You are the river, who's married to the mountains you've known since they were young, who've given themselves to you as you've given yourself to them. You're the canyons you nestle into, each year deeper than the year before. You're the forests who give you their fallen trees, and the meadows you flood and feed, and feed you back their fruits and fine insects who fly to your meadows, to your surface, to be taken in by the fish, who with their own bodies again feed the meadows. You are the river who feeds the ocean, who feels the tides pushing and pulling against your mouth, the waves mixing fresh and salt. You are that intermingling. That's who you are. That's who you've always been. You are the river. You live with volcanoes and glaciers. You've been dammed by lava and ice. You've carried log jams so large and so old they grow their own forests with you running beneath. You've lived through droughts and floods. You are the river. You miss the salmon. You miss the sturgeon. You miss the ocean. You miss the meadows. You miss the forests. You miss the beavers and otters and grizzly bears. You miss the human beings. You are the river. You want them back. You want to feel the tickling of the sturgeon, the thrusting of the salmon. You want to carry food and soil to the ocean. You want to cover the meadows as you used to, and you want to give yourself to them, and you want them to give themselves to you as you've done forever and as they have too. Now, pretend you're a forest. You're the bark of trees and the hairy moss who hangs from them. You're the duff who becomes soil, who becomes trees, who becomes seeds, who becomes squirrels, who become owls, who become slugs, who become shrews, who become soil. You're the trees who cannot live without the fungi, who cannot live without the voles, who cannot live without the trees. You're the fire who cannot live without the trees, who cannot live without the woodpeckers, who cannot live without the beetles, who cannot live without the fire. You're the wind who speaks to the trees and the trees who speak to the wind. You're the birds who sing and the birds who do not. You're the salamanders, the ferns, the millipedes, the bumblebees who sleep on flowers, waiting for the morning to warm you up so you can eat and fly on home. You too have lived through drought and flood, hot and cold, and you too miss the salmon. You miss the owls, the grizzly bears. You miss the rivers. You miss the human beings. You want them all back. You need them back or you will die. And the very, very, very last thing is there's a tradition of the Cheyenne dog soldiers called the pick a pin and stake. Before a battle, a few of the bravest Cheyenne dog soldiers were chosen to wear sashes of tan skins called dog ropes. Attached to each dog rope was a picket pin normally used to tether horses. During battle, the pin would be driven into the ground as a mark of resolve. Once the pin was driven, the dog soldier would remain staked to that piece of ground even to his death. Retreat was no longer an option. The pin could only be removed when everyone was again safe or when another dog soldier relieved him of his duty. It is time. I have driven my picket pin. I am staked out and willing to give in no more. Where will you drive your own picket stake? Where will you choose to make your stand? Give me a threshold, a specific point at which you finally stop running, at which you finally fight back. Stand with me. Stand and fight. I am one, we would be two. Two more might join and we would be four. When four more join, we will be eight, and we'll be eight people fighting whom others will join, and then more people, and more. Stand and fight. The questions before each of us now are, what are your gifts and how can you use them in the service of your land base? What can you do? What does your land base most need from you? How can you achieve it? What do you want to do? And right now, perhaps most important of all, what are you willing to do? People ask me all the time, so Derek, what do you want us to do with all this analysis? And I always say the same thing, which is I want you not to listen to me because I don't live here and I don't know how to live sustainably. If you want to know what to do, go to the Susquehanna and ask it. Go to the nearest forest and ask it. Go to the native soil and ask it. Ask them what they need. and ask them how to live sustainably, and they will tell you. And then really the only question is, are you willing to do it? So thank you very much.